Telling Tales with Ms. G here at 104.3 KTOO. And I have two short stories for you tonight, both rather different, very different, in fact. The first one is by Kate Chopin, and it's Desiree's Baby. It was written in 1893 and published by Vogue, who the writer then, Kate Chopin, was an up-and-coming writer. And it's a very unique tale. It's set in round about the 1800s and set in the South during slavery. So come right back for Desiree's Baby and the Telling Tales with Ms. G. Here tonight, the last one before the new year. Stay tuned at 104.3 KTOO in Juneau. You're tuned in to Telling Tales with Ms. G here at KTOO 104.3. My first story is by Kate Chopin, and it's titled Desiree's Baby. As the day was pleasant, Madame Valmondé drove over to L'Abri to see Desiree and the baby. It made her laugh to think of Desiree with the baby. Why, it seemed but yesterday that Desiree was little more than a baby herself. When Monsieur in riding through the gateway of Valmondé had found her lying asleep in the shadow of the big stone pillar, the little one awoke in his arms and began to cry for Dada. That was as much as she could do or say. Some people thought she might have strayed there of her own accord, for she was of the toddling age. The prevailing belief was that she had been purposely left by a party of Texans whose canvas-covered wagon late in the day had crossed the ferry that Colton Mays kept just below the plantation. In time, Madame Valmondé abandoned every speculation but the one that the child that Desiree had been sent to her by a beneficent providence to be the child of her affection, seeing that she was without child of the flesh. For the girl grew to be beautiful and gentle, affectionate and sincere, the idol of Valmondé. It was no wonder when she stood one day against the stone pillar in whose shadow she had lain asleep 18 years before, that Armand Aubigny, riding by and seeing her there, had fallen in love with her. That was the way all the Aubignys fell in love, as if struck by a pistol shot. The wonder was that he had not loved her before, for he had known her since his father brought him home from Paris, a boy of 8, after his mother died there. The passion that awoke in him that day when he saw her at the gate swept along like an avalanche, or like a prairie fire, or like anything that drives headlong over all obstacles. Monsieur Valmondé grew practical and wanted things well considered. That is, the girl's obscure origin. Armand looked into her eyes and did not care. He was reminded that she was nameless. What did it matter about a name when he could give her one of the oldest and proudest in Louisiana? He ordered the Corbier from Paris and contained himself with what patience he could until it arrived. Then they were married. Madame Valmondé had not seen Desiree and the baby for 4 weeks. When she reached L'Abri, she shuddered at the first sight of it, as she always did. It was a sad-looking place, which for many years had not known the gentle presence of a mistress. Old Monsieur Aubigny, having married and buried his wife in France, and she having loved her own land too well ever to leave it. The roof came down steep and black like a cowl, reaching out beyond the wide galleries that encircled the yellow stuccoed house. Big, solemn oaks grew close to it, and their thick-leaved, far-reaching branches shadowed it like a pall. Young Aubigny's rule was a strict one, too, and under it his slaves had forgotten how to be gay, as they had been during the old master's easygoing and indulgent lifetime. The young mother was recovering slowly and lay full length in her soft white muslins and laces upon a couch. The baby was beside her upon her arm, where he had fallen asleep at her breast. The yellow nurse woman sat beside a window fanning herself. Madame Valmondé bent her portly figure over Desiree and kissed her, holding her an instant tenderly in her arms. Then she turned to the child. "This is not the baby," she exclaimed in startled tones. French was the language spoken at Valmondé in those days. "I knew you would be astonished," laughed Desiree, "at the way he has grown. The little cochon de latte. Look at his legs, Mama, and his hands and fingernails, real fingernails. Zandrine had to cut them this morning. Isn't it true, Zandrine?" The woman bowed her turbaned head majestically. "Merci, madame." "And the way he cries," went on Desiree, "is deafening. Armand heard him the other day as far away as La Blanche's cabin." Madame Valmondé had never removed her eyes from the child. She lifted it and walked with it over to the window that was the lightest. She scanned the baby narrowly, then looked as searchingly at Zandrine, whose face was turned to gaze across the fields. "Yes, the child has grown, has changed," said Madame Valmondé, slowly as she replaced it beside its mother. "What does Armand say?" Desiree's face became suffused with a glow that was happiness itself. "Oh, Armand is the proudest father in the parish, I believe, chiefly because it is a boy, to bear his name, though he says not that he would have loved a girl as well. But I know it isn't true. I know he says that to please me. And Mama," she added, drawing Madame Valmondé's head down to her and speaking in a whisper, "he hasn't punished one of them, not one of them, since baby is born. Even Negrillon, who pretended to have burnt his leg that he might rest from work, he only laughed and said Negrillon was a great scamp. Oh, Mama, I'm so happy. It frightens me." What Desiree said was true. Marriage, and later the birth of his son, had softened Armand Aubigny's imperious and exacting nature greatly. This was what made the gentle Desiree so happy, for she loved him desperately. When he frowned, she trembled, but loved him. When he smiled, she asked no greater blessing of God. But Armand's dark, handsome face had not often been disfigured by frowns since the day he fell in love with her. When the baby was about 3 months old, Desiree awoke one day to the conviction that there was something in the air menacing her peace. It was at first too subtle to grasp. It had only been a disquieting suggestion, an air of mystery among the blacks. Unexpected visits from far-off neighbors who could hardly account for their coming. Then a strange, an awful change in her husband's manner, which she dared not ask him to explain. When he spoke to her, it was with averted eyes, from which the old love light seemed to have gone out. He absented himself from home, and when there, avoided her presence and that of her child without excuse. And the very spirit of Satan seemed suddenly to take hold of him in his dealings with the slaves. Desiree was miserable enough to die. She sat in her room one hot afternoon in her peignoir, listlessly drawing through her fingers the strands of her long, silky brown hair that hung about her shoulders. The baby, half-naked, lay asleep upon her great mahogany bed that was like a sumptuous throne with its satin-lined half-canopy. One of La Blanche's little quadroon boys, half-naked, too, stood fanning the child slowly with a fan of peacock feathers. Desiree's eyes had been fixed absently and sadly upon the baby. While she was striving to penetrate the threatening mist that she felt closing about her, she looked from her child to the boy who stood beside him, and back again, over and over. Ah! It was a cry that she could not help, which she was not conscious of having uttered. The blood turned like ice in her veins, and a clammy moisture gathered upon her face. She tried to speak to the little boy, but no sound would come at first. When he heard his name uttered, he looked up, and his mistress was pointing to the door. He laid aside the great soft fan and obediently stole away, over the polished floor, on his bare tiptoes. She stayed motionless, with gaze riveted upon her child, and her face the picture of fright. Presently her husband entered the room, and without noticing her, went to a table and began to search among some papers which covered it. "Armand," she called to him, in a voice which must have stabbed him, if he was human. But he did not notice. "Armand," she said again. Then she rose and tottered towards him. "Armand," she panted once more, clutching his arm, "look at our child. What does it mean? Tell me." He coldly but gently loosened her fingers from about his arm and thrust the hand away from him. "Tell me what it means," she cried despairingly. "It means," he answered lightly, "that the child is not white. It means that you are not white." A quick conception of all that this accusation meant for her nerved her with unwonted courage to deny it. "It is a lie. It is not true. I am white. Look at my hair. It is brown, and my eyes are gray. Armand, you know they are gray, and my skin is fair," seizing his wrist. "Look at my hand, whiter than yours, Armand," she laughed hysterically. "As white as La Blanche's," he returned cruelly, and went away, leaving her alone with their child. When she could hold a pen in her hand, she sent a despairing letter to Madame Valmondé. "My mother, they tell me I am not white. Armand has told me I am not white. For God's sake, tell them it is not true. You must know it is not true. I shall die. I must die. I cannot be so unhappy and live." The answer that came was as brief. "My own Desiree, come home to Valmondé, back to your mother who loves you. Come with your child." When the letter reached Desiree, she went with it to her husband's study and laid it open upon the desk before which he sat. She was like a stone image, silent, white, motionless, after she placed it there. In silence, he ran his cold eyes over the written words. He said nothing. "Shall I go, Armand?" she asked in tones sharp with agonized suspense. "Yes, go." "Do you want me to go?" "Yes, I want you to go."
He thought Almighty God had dealt cruelly and unjustly with him, and felt somehow that he was paying him back in kind when he stabbed thus into his wife's soul. Moreover, he no longer loved her because of the unconscious injury she had brought upon his home and his name. She turned away like one stunned by a blow and walked slowly towards the door, hoping he would call her back. "Goodbye, Armand," she moaned. He did not answer her. That was his last blow at fate. Desiree went in search of her child. Zandrine was pacing the somber gallery with it. She took the little one from the nurse's arms with no word of explanation and, descending the steps, walked away under the live oak branches. It was an October afternoon. The sun was just sinking. Out in the steel fields, the slaves were picking cotton. Desiree had not changed the thin white garment nor the slippers which she wore. Her hair was uncovered, and the sun's rays brought a golden gleam from its brown meshes. She did not take the broad, beaten road which led to the far-off plantation of Almonde. She walked across a deserted field, where the stubble bruised her tender feet. So delicately shod and torn, her thin gown to shreds. She disappeared among the reeds and willows that grew thick along the banks of the deep, sluggish bayou, and she did not come back again. Some weeks later, there was a curious scene enacted at Libri. In the center of the smoothly swept backyard was a great bonfire. Armand Aubigny sat in the wide hallway that commanded a view of the spectacle, and it was he who dealt out to a half dozen slaves the material which kept this fire ablaze, a graceful cradle of willow with all its dainty furbishings was laid upon the pyre, which had already been fed with the richness of a priceless layette. Then there were silk gowns and velvet and satin ones added to these, laces too and embroideries, bonnets and gloves, for the corbier had been of rare quality. The last thing to go was a tiny bundle of letters, innocent little scribblings that Desiree had sent to him during the days of their espousal. There was the remnant of one back in the drawer from which he took them, but it was not Desiree's. It was part of an old letter from his mother to his father. He read it. She was thanking God for the blessing of her husband's love. "But, above all," she wrote, "night and day, I thank the good God for having so arranged our lives that our dear Armand will never know that his mother, who adores him, belongs to the race that is cursed with the brand of slavery." That was Kate Chopin's Desiree's Baby. I hope you enjoyed that. It definitely leaves some questions to your mind. What happened to Desiree and her baby? And what will happen to Armand? This is Ms. G bringing you Telling Tales here tonight. I'll be right back. Please stay tuned. Thank you. and hello. This is Ms. G still bringing you Telling Tales here tonight at 104.3 KTOO in Juneau. And my next story is actually a spooky one. It's called Der Belznickel, and it's by retold by F.E. Schlosser. So, I'll get right to it. My sisters and my baby brother danced around the house, whispering to each other excitedly about the coming of Der Belznickel on that snowy December 5th evening, the day before the feast of St. Nicholas. According to the stories, the good St. Nicholas chains up the devil on the eve of his birthday, December 6th, and makes him visit all of the children in the village to see if they have been behaving themselves and deserve the attention of Kirschkindl. Those who are good will receive gifts, but those who are naughty, well, those children who do not know their prayers or their school recitations or who have been troublesome at home might find themselves whipped with Der Belznickel switch, are tied up with his chains, and they will receive coal in their stockings instead of presents. Of course, I did not participate in the excited whisperings or silly romping of the youngsters. I was above such foolishness, having turned 12 on my last birthday. Instead, I peeled potatoes in the kitchen to help mein Mutter with dinner. I heard several pairs of feet stampeding up the stairs and shaking the floorboards over my head and sighed a little at all the dramatics. Just then, someone tugged on my skirt and I looked down at Hans, my 3-year-old brother. "Gretel, will der Belznickel come tonight?" he asked me, his huge blue eyes wide with anxiety. I scooped him up into my arms and gave him a reassuring hug. "Yes, Hans, he will come tonight," I told him. And he would, too. I had seen Uncle Oscar stashing a dark costume consisting of raggedy fur-trimmed black clothes, a headband with goat horns glued to the top, a long whippy switch, and a thick, rattling chain in the empty stall in the barn about an hour before sunset. Right after dinner, Uncle Oscar would duck out to see the horses, and a few moments later, Der Belznickel would make his visit to see if we children had been good enough to receive the attention of St. Nicholas. "Will he have a switch and chains? Will he tie us up?" Hans asked. "Der Belznickel only ties up naughty little boys and girls. But you have been good, so you do not need to worry," I said. I put him down and he scampered off upstairs to talk to Inga and my other sisters while I finished the potatoes. There were 14 of us at dinner that night, Mutter, Vater, my 4 sisters and 3 brothers, Uncle Oscar, Aunt Helga, their 2 children, and me. As the oldest child, I watched over the others and made sure that the babies got fed. Then Uncle Oscar slipped out to feed the horses, and the grown-ups exchanged happy grins over the little children's heads. The first sign that Der Belznickel was approaching was a loud, rude banging on the front windows. Hans and Inga screamed when a soot-covered face with long black whiskers was pressed against the glass. Then the front door burst open and Der Belznickel rumbled into the parlor, rattling his chains. The children cowered and whimpered and screamed half in fear and half in delight at the raggedy creature with his goat's horns and bag full of something. Was it candy or coal? The answer depended on what happened next. Der Belznickel made all of us, even me, line up in a row in our parlor. Starting with me, we began to answer whatever questions he asked us. He rattled his switch at me and made me quote the scripture passage from last Sunday's church service. Martin, the next oldest, recited a poem he had memorized for school, and on down the line. Every time we got an answer right, Der Belznickel would stomp about in rage because he hadn't tricked us, and the little ones would squeal. I was distracted from Uncle Oscar's antics by a strange flickering in the lantern light. Something was wrong with Uncle Oscar's shadow. I began watching his shadow as he made Ludwig recite next. When Uncle Oscar lunged one way, the shadow went the opposite way. As I watched, it lifted the chains over its head. The shadow's hands seemed impossibly long, and the fingers looked more like claws. I shivered, chills running over my skin. The horns on the shadow's head were very sharp, and the legs impossibly long. Then the shadow broke away from Uncle Oscar completely, just as Ludwig finished his recitation. While the grown-ups and children all cheered for Ludwig's success, the shadow slid over the wall like oil and coiled up near the ceiling. Then it opened glowing yellow eyes and looked straight at me. I gasped, my heart pounding in my throat, and I could feel my legs shaking. My terror was masked by the happy shrieks of the youngest children who were watching Uncle Oscar, the pretend Belsnickel, stomping up and down the hallway, rattling his chains and howling in anger. I faced the opposite direction toward the corner of the room, watching the real Belsnickel slide down the wall, his shadowy form slowly solidifying into a short, twisted figure dressed in coal black fur with a broken nose and glowing yellow eyes. No one else noticed him as he slithered like a snake past my parents and Aunt Helga and began stalking the hallway at Uncle Oscar's heels. My stomach was twisted into a knot. I wanted to run away and be sick, but I couldn't tear my eyes off the evil figure that stopped before my cousins and watched as they spelled several difficult words at Uncle Oscar's request. Johanna stumbled a bit, and Der Belsnickel gave an audible chuckle and seemed to grow larger within the shadow of my Uncle Oscar. When Johanna recovered herself enough to finish spelling her words successfully, Der Belsnickel shrunk in size and frowned. Occasionally, the creature would dart a look at me and give me a twisted grin. Little Hans was the last one in line, and he was terrified. He stared up at large Uncle Oscar and couldn't breathe a word. "Have you been a good boy?" Uncle Oscar asked, taking pity on the small figure. Hans nodded verbally, and Uncle Oscar patted his head and handed him a boiled sweet. Behind him, Der Belsnickel stomped in rage and then dematerialized, becoming a thick black oozing mass that gradually sank back into Uncle Oscar's shadow and was gone. I staggered a little, as if a weight had been released from me, and stared suspiciously at the shadow, wondering if the creature was really gone for good. My siblings and cousins were mobbing Uncle Oscar, demanding sweets for Der Belsnickel, since they had all done so well with their recitations. As he handed out the treats, I heard a knock at the window. I looked out into a pair of glowing yellow eyes and a twisted face. "I will see you again next year, Gretel," Der Belsnickel hissed through the glass. "Try not to be too good." I screamed then and fainted, toppling to the floor before my vater could catch me. They told me later that all was confusion in the parlor for several minutes, during which time Uncle Oscar slipped away. I awoke to the stinging sensation of smelling salts and clung to my Mutter and cried as if I were no older than Hans. My siblings and cousins laughed at me, their own fear forgotten, but my Mutter hushed them, realizing that my terror had nothing to do with Uncle Oscar. She sent them away to the kitchen to eat their sweets. When they were gone, I told Mutter and Vater and Uncle Aunt Helga what I had seen and heard. Vater nodded his head several times as I spoke and then said, "Mein Kind, I once saw the real Der Belsnickel too, when I was about your age. I will tell you now what my Vater told me then. Der Belsnickel is bound by the goodness of Saint Nicholas. If you are a good child, if you do your best and try to be kind and say your prayers, no harm will come to you." I shuddered, remembering the look on Der Belsnickel's face when he called my name. "I will, Vater, I will," I promised fervently. "I have heard that people who see Der Belsnickel also have the good fortune to see St. Nicholas," and Helga added unexpectedly. "My Mutter told me that she saw them both at the feast the year she turned 12. Watch carefully tomorrow, Gretel, and you may also see the blessed saint." The grown-ups hustled me to bed after that, and Mutter tucked me up tight. I was quickly joined by my sisters, who drifted off immediately, but I couldn't sleep. I kept seeing the leering face of Der Belsnickel before me and hearing him call my name. Downstairs, the grandfather clock chimed the hours away as the house grew quiet and the adults went to bed. As time ticked its way toward midnight, a moonbeam shone through the window, shining across the room and dazzling my eyes. Beautiful it was, and comforting. I slipped out of bed and went to look out at the moon that was turning our room into a shadowy and mysterious place. It was as bright as noon outside, and the trees and bushes cast serene shadows over the snowy landscape. Then I saw, riding up to the road on a dashing white horse, was a bearded man dressed in red with white fur lining his hood. It was St. Nicholas. Running before him and muttering darkly was Drabuznicko. The grim little figure seemed more comic than scary now, bound by his rattling chains and forced to dance to the whim of the good saint behind him. For a moment, the saint paused in front of my house and looked up at my window. He raised a solemn hand to me, and I smiled and waved back. Then he spurred his horse away down the road, Drabuznicko scampering ahead of him like a little black dog, and they disappeared into the dazzling snowscape under the light of the full moon. With a soft sigh, I returned to the comfort of my bed, sensing that this was the last time I would see either Drabuznicko or St. Nicholas. And I knew something else, too. I knew that I had nothing to fear from the grim little creature now, not ever. I fell asleep with a smile on my face and awoke the next morning to the joyful shouts of my siblings on St. Nicholas Day. This has been Telling Tales with Ms. Chi for the last one of 2014. Have a wonderful, happy new year and a safe one. Until next time, good night.